It's Friday, April 15, 2011. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. Colin Powell was then Secretary of State of the United States. He gave this piece of advice to then-President George W. Bush. "Mr. President," he said, "remember the sign at Pottery Barn. You break it, you bought it." That actually is a very sage and wise word of advice for a president considering military intervention. In that case, President George W. Bush was considering the United States invasion of Iraq. And the Secretary of State was offering to the president a word of advice about how difficult it might be to extricate the United States from that kind of military endeavor. The history of warfare, and especially in the modern age, the history of military intervention by strong nations within weaker nations, demonstrates that there is a very stable fact. It has almost become an inexorable fact of foreign policy. Even a major nation, a world power like the United States, finds it very difficult to withdraw itself from certain military endeavors, especially when it is difficult to know exactly what the goal of the military intervention is. Keep that in mind in terms of Libya. The Wall Street Journal's editorial of yesterday speaks of the Libya stalemate. As it begins, NATO's internal debate over Libya has now broken into public view, with Britain and France publicly blaming other members of the slow pace, that is, for the slow pace of the bombing campaign. And, of course, some of those they are blaming include the United States of America. Now, even as this report was coming out in an editorial form in the Wall Street Journal, the international media were suggesting that the Allies were at least settled on the fact that the military intervention would now have to continue until Muammar Gaddafi is removed from office. Now, that may seem obvious given the threat that Muammar Gaddafi really represents for his own people, but the difficulty with this is that now, several days after the military intervention has begun, Muammar Gaddafi is, if anything, even more settled in power. You may remember that President Barack Obama, in speaking to the American people about this, said that the American involvement would be for a matter of weeks, perhaps even for a matter of days. Well, it doesn't look that way now. And that Pottery Barn sign must come back into the American consciousness. If you break it, you bought it. And by military intervention within Libya, the United States has bought itself a new national responsibility. As the Wall Street Journal editorialized, as the conflict draws on, Gaddafi is playing for a stalemate that leaves him in control of Tripoli and other coastal cities, buying time to fight another day. What it really looks like is eventuating from this is a partition of the nation, something like a stable and long-lasting civil war. As the editorial states, that would mean a de facto partition of Libya, with periodic outbreaks of fighting or civil war. Who knows what a vengeful Gaddafi clan might attempt if they stay in power, especially if they get access to oil revenues again. The editorial ends with these words: "However reluctantly President Obama went along with this intervention, the U.S. and NATO are now committed. The longer the war goes on, the more Libyan civilians will suffer despite the humanitarian justification of the original U.N. resolution. If the U.S., France, and Britain can't topple a ten-horned despot like Gaddafi, who is loathed by most of his own people, the damage to Western credibility will be severe and long-lasting." That's how the editorial ends, and I can't think of a word that could be appropriately added to it. In the United States of America, the big news has to do with the federal budget, the budget deficit, and now the war of plans to reduce that deficit offered by the Republicans, especially in what is now known as the Ryan Plan, and now by the President of the United States. In the middle of this week, President Obama called for $4 trillion in cuts to the deficit, which were a combination of cuts in spending and increased taxes, as he says, taxes on the wealthy. Now, we need to keep several things in mind here. What we have here is a political battle between two parties. What we have here is a political debate between two different understandings of government. What we have here is, of course, sometimes more and sometimes less than meets the eye. When you have something like the federal budget with all of its numbers, its complexity, and its digits being debated, the reality is sometimes very hard to grasp. Now, for instance, if you talk about the American press, the headlines were President Obama calls for over $4 trillion in cuts. I have in my hands the Financial Times of London. It reports that the Obama administration now calls for $4,000 billion in cuts. In other words, even trying to get a handle on the number, and by the way, those are the same numbers, they are very difficult sometimes to imagine, much less to reconcile in the mind. Now, one of the things that the Obama administration is clearly pressing for, and here the president is making the case himself to the American people, is that there must be increases in some taxes. One of the illusions about this we need to keep in mind, regardless of one's partisan bent, is that taxes are never so simple as they appear. And when you have a tax, for instance, in one part of the economy, it can have impact throughout the economy in ways that are very much unpredicted. Now, one of the things you will hear in the midst of this debate is that there has to be some kind of compromise. Well, that's the nature of politics. But both sides right now have very clearly defined plans, very clearly defined purposes, and very clearly defined principles, at least in terms of the political debate, more principled and more distinct than at any time in recent history. Now, why has it happened now? It's happened now because the budget deficit is simply now impossible to ignore. What we're looking at is a direct threat to future generations of Americans. And what we're looking at is the fact that the United States has only been able to fund its deficit spending by borrowing money, especially on the international markets, and particularly from China. But China will not always want to offer that kind of lending. And the money is going to have to come from somewhere, or the cuts are going to have to come themselves. Now, one of the most important things to recognize in all of this, even in this debate, is that there is, even though the partisan parties want to make it as invisible as possible, a considerable amount of common ground. For the first time, for instance, you have a Democratic president, especially one as liberal as President Barack Obama, suggesting that there have to be actual, very real, long-lasting, if not permanent, cuts in federal spending. That's something that's new. Now, how exactly this budget process goes forward, remember, the threatened showdown was over the 2011 budget. We're not even talking yet about the 2012 budget in terms of the actual vote. When it comes to reducing the deficit, we're talking about something that will go far beyond fiscal year 2012. But we're talking about something that you can count on being central to the presidential election in 2012. Now, I mentioned something about a fallen world and difficult figures. Well, that's just one of the realities of our contemporary political context. It's hard to know exactly what we're talking about, even when we say, yes, we're making spending cuts. That becomes clear. And it's important in this case that the article appears in the New York Times rather than the Wall Street Journal. The Wall Street Journal is more traditionally the conservative paper of record, even as the New York Times is the nation's more liberal paper of record. The headline is, in budget's fine print, there are real and illusory cuts. As Eric Lichtbau and Ron Nixon report, with the line-by-line details of the deal finally made public, budget documents that show that a $20 million program at the Department of Housing and Urban Development meant to root out mortgage fraud is being reduced to zero. So there you have a program. That was something that amounted to $20 million. It's simply zeroed out. But what about the $6.2 billion that was cut from the Commerce Department? That sounds like a huge figure, but it's actually illusory. That $6.2 billion was spending that happened this past year in the 2010 census. There isn't a census in 2012, and that money wouldn't have ever been spent anyway. So that $6.2 billion in tax cuts championed by both the Democrats and the Republicans is actually no tax savings at all. Also, a good number of the cuts in the budget for fiscal year 2011 were for appropriations that would never have been spent anyway. Well, all that to say, just remember that when you talk about a budget of this complexity, trillions and trillions of dollars, we're talking about the opportunity in a fallen world for a good deal of misinformation to be shared by virtually everyone who has a stake in this argument. Now, in a fallen world, one of the realities is that every economic system is broken. The question is, which economic system is less broken than any other? There is no economic utopianism that Christians can find as any kind of solace or confidence in. To the contrary, we have to understand that economic systems actually reflect the moral state of the people who are a part of that economy. Now, consider that when you remember that the Senate has released a major report on this last great financial crisis. This report is known as, quote, Wall Street and the Financial Crisis, Anatomy of a Financial Collapse, end quote. It was released on Wednesday by the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations. And by the way, it's a bipartisan committee. The co-chairmen are Carl Levin, a Democrat of Michigan, and Tom Coburn, a Republican of Oklahoma. As is reported in the New York Times, the result of 2 years' work, the report carries on an array of institutions. It focuses on an array of institutions with central roles in the mortgage crisis, including, for instance, Washington Mutual, an aggressive mortgage leader that collapsed in 2008, the Office of Thrift Supervision, by the way, that comes in for a tremendous amount of criticism. Now, this is a huge investigative report in the New York Times. It's actually one of two that appeared in Thursday's newspaper, and both of them, for Christians, have a great deal to offer in terms of material for thought. For instance, the report from the Senate includes 19 recommendations. It not only looks backwards to the cause of the crisis, it looks forward saying, how can we prevent this in the future? 19 different recommendations, including changes to the regulatory and industry practices that are allowed, These include creating strong conflict of interest policies at the nation's banks and requiring that banks hold higher reserves against risky mortgages. The report also asked federal regulators to examine its findings for violations of laws. Now, something that emerges out of this report is the fact that the regulators and the federal government often had to ask the financial institutions how they should be regulated. Now, if you think that's strange, well, let me just suggest to you that it comes down to the fact that this is such a complex operation. So many of these financial dealings were so complex that completely boggle the imagination that those who work for us and the regulatory agencies weren't able to keep up with it. Now, what do we learn from all of this? Well, in a fallen world, we should expect fallen business practices, and we should expect exactly what happened in this collapse. We should also expect that people will want some kind of easy answer about how this can be prevented in the future. There will be new regulations, and there already are new regulatory agencies. But the bad news for us to remember is that new forms of economic fraud and malfeasance are going to be probably very different than those these regulations are meant to address. This kind of regulation, this kind of statutory law, is actually retrospective. It looks back to the problems of the past. It cannot foresee the problems of the future. That's just beyond our ability. Now, there's a great deal of frustration in that, of course, and that frustration appeared in yesterday's front page of the New York Times, a headline, "A Financial Crisis with Little Guilt." The subhead was, "After Widespread Reckless Banking, a Dearth of Prosecutions." Now, that's a very interesting investigative report that is in tandem with the one considering the Senate investigation. And here's what it comes down to. It comes down to the fact that there have been almost no major federal prosecutions for anyone who was involved in and responsible for this financial collapse. Why is it so? Well, there are many different reasons that are offered here in the report. The first one that's cited is the fact that given the economic uncertainty, the federal government had to put its energies into buttressing the economy rather than trying to arrest and prosecute those who were involved in the crisis. But as you dig through the data, you come to something that's even a bit more ominous. It's difficult to know that many of these things were actually, well, to use the word that is of central importance here, illegal. You can arrest someone, but you really can't prosecute them unless, according to our rule of law, they broke the law. And that gets back to the fact that these regulations and statutes are often focused on the past rather than the present or the future. You can't keep up with sin. You can't keep up with a sinful imagination. You can't keep up with sinners who will devise new ways to sin. You can't keep up with bankers who are going to find and devise new ways to do sophisticated financial dealings. That's not to say that the regulatory impulse has no validity whatsoever. It is to say you can't keep up with it. Not in a fallen world. The sinful imagination is greater than any regulatory power. It also reminds us again of something that we as Christians have to keep ever in our minds. We want the solace and the satisfaction of the guilty arrested, tried, prosecuted, and punished. But in a fallen world, even our justice system, operating at its best, can't achieve anything close to perfect justice. In this case, there may be people who, in terms of morality, who should go to jail, who will not, because the laws simply were not on the books. The prosecutory ability certainly was not there. In that case, it's going to have to wait a final judgment. But even as we find some comfort in that, even as we're yearning for that, we need to remember that but for the redemption that is ours in Jesus Christ, that would be true not just for some Wall Street bankers who may have been involved in malfeasance, but for every single one of us. Today's tax day, that's going to be in the imagination of many people. But today also was important for another reason. 146 years ago today, President Abraham Lincoln died, having been assassinated by a single assassin who shot him the previous night in Ford's Theater in Washington. Now, this comes as an anniversary, even as we approach the 150th anniversary of the United States Civil War. History is distant from us. Historical judgments are still difficult to make and contested. We'll be talking about that a lot as we go through the anniversary of the Civil War and all its aftermath. But in the meantime, let's just remember that as Christians, we are accountable to do our very best to come to a knowledge of the truth and to make judgments that are based upon a biblical understanding and a Christian worldview. There are so many things that are a part of this equation, but we certainly need to keep in mind that an anniversary such as this reminds us that history is not, as Henry Ford once said, just one thing after another. History matters. Just remember what happened 146 years ago today in that little house across from Ford's Theater when President Abraham Lincoln died. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmiller.com. You'll find also more information about Southern Seminary by going to sbts.edu. For information about Boyce College, go to boycecollege.com. You can also follow me at Twitter by going to twitter.com/AlbertMoeller. I'll meet you again next week for The Briefing.